Hello and welcome to Max Politics. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette here on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Thanks very much for tuning in here for the show. It's Friday, February 24th, 2023. On this episode of the show, we are talking about Black political power in New York. We can and have pegged this conversation to it being Black History Month, but this is obviously a conversation for any time of year and any year in New York and beyond. It's a conversation that entered a new phase in recent years with the ascension of a long list of Black political leaders in New York. My guest today, Keith Wright. Keith Wright is currently the leader of the Manhattan Democratic Party, a vice chair in the New York State Democratic Party, which he formerly co-chaired. And since leaving the assembly in 2017, he's been working at the firm Davidoff, Hutcher and Citron LLP, where he is the director of strategic planning for their government relations group. Keith Wright, thank you for being here. Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me, Ben. It's a pleasure to join you this morning.
So as I'm going through this list of the many Black political leaders in New York today, what's going through your mind? Or it's obviously not news to you, but how do you assess this current moment we're in of an immense amount of Black political leadership? Now, it's been for decades that there's been growing and more Black political leadership in New York, but correct me if I'm wrong, this really feels like a new and heightened phase of Black political leadership in New York. How do you assess the moment we're in?
Well, you know, it's interesting. And all of the names that you've mentioned are certainly folks that I have served with, interacted with, grown up politically, so to speak, with. And I've never really thought about it until you were talking and speaking of their names. I chalk it up to folks, some folks older than others, but folks, you know, in our communities wanting to make our communities a better place. I chalk it up to competency. I chalk it up to absolute competency. All of those names that you mentioned, they're all extremely intelligent, extremely competent folks that have decided that public service was their calling. And the other thing is that you can't put any of these folks in a cookie cutter. Mm-hmm. They're not homogeneous. I mean, they're all different. They all may have some different philosophies on certain issues. You can't pigeonhole them just because they're Black. Mm-hmm. You can't do that. And we all have had different, I guess, well been trained, I guess, by different people. Because, I mean, who you are trained by, who you come up with as a staff person, if you will, because most of the folks that you mentioned were staff people, I guess, in politics. I'll never forget. When I got out of law school, the only thing I really wanted to do was work for Charlie Rangel, because I was, mm-hmm. I'd grown up, I was able to, Adam Clayton Powell was my congressperson, and I'd grown up listening to this larger than life political figure who everyone throughout the nation was talking about. And I was so proud that he was my congressperson and all the things that he had done, and of course that didn't work out working for Charlie Rangel. Mm-hmm. But then I made a decision that I wanted to be his peer, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so then I started working for, I'll never forget when I got my last unemployment check for the city of New York, and this was 1984. Dave Dinkins was running for Manhattan Borough President, and he called me to become his director of his Harlem office in 1985, and he paid me, I think, $25,000 in 1985, and it was one of the best jobs that I've ever had. I got to learn under David. Of course, I had known David. We lived in the same building, a building in which I still live. I live in my same old rent-stabilized apartment, and gladly to do so. But a lot of these folks, you know, they've been trained by different people, trained in different ways. So, as I said, they're not homogeneous, but they represent their communities well. And certainly a guy like Alvin Bragg, you mentioned, I used to babysit this guy. And he is, I think, done us all very, very proud.
You know, it's a key point you mentioned, obviously. This is, you can't say, oh, this is a group of black elected officials and they all are the same, or they all think the same, or even they hold all the same political positions. Of course not.
No.
And so before maybe we get into a little bit of that and the question of unity, and there was recently a summit focused on public safety that Reverend Al Sharpton organized that brought a lot of these black leaders together to talk about public safety and unity and trying not to have as many public disagreements perhaps as there have been, and being more on the same page in terms of what's getting aired out in public and having more private conversations to be more unified. Say a little bit more about your upbringing in politics and sort of the Harlem politics that you came up in the 70s and the 80s, and what the sort of atmosphere was around the question of black political power.
Well, oh God, my upbringing in politics, and that's a question that I guess you're always trying to seek answers to. But I graduated from college in 1977, and I was searching for things to do and such. And in 1978, my father ran for a countywide Supreme Court judgeship. And you got to remember, back in Manhattan, I think we had only had the only other countywide position was Percy Sutton, who had been Manhattan Borough President, I think, from 66 to around 1974, 75, somewhere in there. So that was countywide. So my father, who was appointed to the criminal court in 1970 by then Mayor John Lindsay, my father had received a lot of notoriety because of his bail policies. He was given the nickname by the Police Benevolent Association, or as my father liked to call it, the Police Malevolent Association. And then he was not going to be reappointed by then Mayor Koch. And so so he ran for a judgeship. For Supreme Court. So that first time that he ran in 1977, he didn't make it. But we were going all up and down the island, all up and down the island. And it was a big deal that a black guy was running for something throughout the borough of Manhattan. So 1978, with the help of a guy by the name of Denny Farrell, mm-hmm. who was then the county leader, a black guy, a black assembly person from Washington Heights, and a guy by the name of Bill Lynch, who was the, he was a labor organizer at that point. And Bill Lynch was the campaign manager. It was a woman from the Upper West Side. I'll never forget her. She became another campaign manager by the name of Bobby Berlin, Elaine Bobby Berlin. And they took over my father's campaign because he didn't really he wasn't politically astute. Let's just put it that way. He was not a member of a political party at that point, even when he was appointed to judge. And he ran countywide. So I saw that. I saw that. I was exposed to that. And as luck would have it, we were able to win. And So then he got a 14-year appointment by being elected. So that's what I saw. You know, just to give you an example of some of my father's political naivete, when he first ran for office, he had this campaign, made a campaign office, but he was not supported by some of the local Harlem elected officials. Specifically, a guy by the name of Fred Samuel, who was the New York City councilman at that point. And so one day after the campaign was over, my father said he ran into Fred because he lived around the corner. He said, "Well, Fred, I ran for office, running for a judgeship. I mean, how come you didn't support me? I mean, I really could have used your support. You know, I needed help. We could have won this thing, but you know, you didn't come on board." And Fred Samuel looked him dead in the eye. And I was there. I remember I was, 22 years old. And Fred said, "You never asked." So that was...
That's a lesson for you, right? When you're starting your political career.
And that's a lesson, right, exactly. Uh-huh. So the next time around, of course, my father asked everybody. So.
Yeah.
But that was my first foray into politics. And then I volunteered on a number of campaigns after that because I enjoyed it. And... and I never knew people got paid to work on campaigns until I ran for office myself. And everybody said, "Well, you know, listen, you got to pay me for this. You got to pay me for that."
And you became a district leader.
Well, in 1991, and Dinkins won in 1989. And I was working for the MTA at that point in government affairs. But in 1991... And I had just had a child and just recently married. And I was trying to, you know, make sure I had an income to support the family and such.
Sure.
But I missed the hell out of politics, though, at that point. I was missing it a lot. So, with the help, my first political partner, I guess, was a woman named C. Virginia Fields, who became councilperson and Manhattan Borough president. And she was looking for a co-district leader. And she asked, and I accepted. And the political club, the political organization that we helped build, still stands to this day.
And was that the moment where you knew, oh, this is where I'm heading? And then the run for assembly was pretty soon after that, right?
So yeah, it was.
Did you know at that moment, or were you still saying,
I knew I always knew that I wanted to be elected at some point. But I became district leader, and you know, I just was just trying to be I was just so excited to become it. Number one, I was so excited to have been asked. And number two, I was so excited to serve as a district leader. Let me just say this. You know, anytime you're elected to anything or any sort of position that you have in public service, it is not the most glamorous thing in the world. I just want to make that clear. It's about public service. It's about service. It's about helping Ms. Johnson with the shopping cart out of the St. Nicholas projects. It's about helping Ms. Rodriguez in one of the tenement buildings. Helping to fight her eviction, making sure that Mr. Johnson or Mr. Williams has his heat and hot water. That's really what it's all about. And so I did that and tried to keep my political club afloat. And we were like odd political club. We used to have not monthly meetings, but we would have weekly meetings. And because we wanted to keep people engaged and
yeah, it's a better way to organize,
and
right?
We used to do a weekly meeting. And we do it to this day, but it's, So the next year, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'll get back to your question. The next year, the current assembly person was a woman by the name of Geraldine Daniels. And And we got wind that she was not going to run again, and she wanted to bequeath the seat to her son. And of course, all of the Harlem elected officials and such lined up behind her son, who was a commissioner or something of the state liquor authority. And about nine people ran, just like for any open seat, you'll always have a lot of people that will run, some qualified, some not qualified. So I was one of the persons that ran. And as I said, I mean, you know, Charlie Rangel, Percy Sutton, Carl McCall, a lot of the folks, they lined up behind Geraldine's son. And there was another woman that ran in that race, a woman named Peggy Shepherd, who was able to get a lot of the union, the labor union support, whether it's 1199 and DC 37. So, I mean, you know, I had relatives.
So how'd you pull that one out? How did you win that?
That was the question. Well, I mean, listen, I was a known commodity in the neighborhood. As I said, that my father was he was a lawyer for many, many years, and he was a judge for many years who had achieved a lot of notoriety. My mother also was the principal of the local public school across the street from where I lived. Well, I never went to that school. I did spend a lot of time in the principal's office. I helped a lot of people when I worked for Dave Dinkins as a director at Harlem Office.
Sure, so, you weren't a nobody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was a known commodity to some extent. And we worked very hard.
Yeah,
I mean, I think I must have knocked on at least 5,000 doors myself, and people vote for different reasons. They will vote for you because you come to their church. They'll vote for you if you come to their little, I don't know, their four-year-old son's birthday party. Mm-hmm. They'll vote for you if you come to the sixth grade graduation. I did all of those things, and they'll vote for you. I mean, if you have a sweatsuit on rather than a shirt and tie. I mean, people vote for different.
But you got at something that I wanted to ask you about, where you said, you know, this work is about helping, and you gave a couple of examples of people. And so I'm interested in this question of, you know, your memories of how sort of the the Harlem project of electing more Black leaders to office. As you said, there was this, you know, progression of getting into countywide positions from more localized offices, right? Which are, could be Harlem based in the state legislature, the city council, and so forth. But to go countywide and then to go citywide, these are efforts at organizing, fundraising, coalition building, and so forth. And they're to win elections, but also at the base of that is about helping people, and often, of course, trying to make sure that the Black residents and voters of New York City are not ignored by the power structures. Say a little bit about what that mindset was like in those years of the 70s and 80s and into Dinkins's win in the 89 mayoral race, and this sort of, you know, he had to run several times to be borough president, right? He had to be convinced to run for mayor once he finally won that position. I remember we actually had him on a prior version of the show a few years back before his recent passing, of course. And he talked about how he finally got that position of Manhattan borough president that he'd been trying so hard for. He didn't want to take a chance of leaving it to run for mayor, but he had to be convinced. But say a little bit about sort of what that culture and that atmosphere was like in terms of the project of winning seats outside of Harlem and winning countywide as your father did and winning citywide as Dinkins did, and what that sort of mindset was like in terms of being able to, as you said, help people.
Well, I don't know if there was one thing. Well, I was.
Or take issue. Yeah. Take issue with my framing of the question, please.
No, not at all. I guess what I'm, I mean, I was there when David ran for borough president two times, and he ran against some formidable people. Andrew Stein, who at that point was, might have been the city council president, or Andrew Stein, or he was Manhattan borough president. Let me just put it that way. And I think they had some head-to-head battles. And you got to remember, in 1985, when David finally ran, he ran against a guy by the name of Jerry Nadler, who from the Upper West Side. So, and then when he did finally win, and he was borough president for 4 years, that's when I was working for him. Right. And you're right, he did have to be convinced, because, you know, Dave was not a rich man. Dave was not rich, and when he became borough president, and his wife was working at the tax department, you know, they were a middle class black family who just couldn't shirk any income. So, yes, he had to be convinced, and I'm glad he was convinced. And, and Dave was a consensus builder. He was a coalition builder. I mean, that's what he did. He believed in that. And quite frankly, I remember he ran against, I think, Jay Golden, Ed Koch, and someone else ran in that race. It was a 4 or 5 way race, but he ran for mayor in 1980 in the Democratic primary. And Ed Koch had just finished up, I think, his third term, I believe, and he did win. But I don't think there was any sort of conspiracy, for want of a better word, or agenda to run for other offices. You know, it kind of grew organically. At that point, I mean, we had Charlie Rangel at one point, I guess during the 70s, and they were always trying to talk him into running against Ed Koch. You had Basil Patterson at that point, who people were trying to talk about running against Ed Koch for mayor. Because, I mean, this, you know, I guess at that point, you know, the black community in particular knew it to be time for a change. But also, because I remember being in a room with Bill Lynch, and they were counting, I guess the black population of the city at that point might have been somewhere around 20-25%. The Latino population may have been around the same, which, you know, they were counting up votes, and if they could organize people of color, and certainly your, you know, some of your white more liberal leadership, put in anybody that can put that coalition together would win citywide. Mm-hmm. And that's what David did. But I don't know if there was any, and it might have been a planned agenda for that particular race, but I don't know what, and I don't know if it really, if there was any planned agenda for the outgrowth of it. I think just kind of happened organically. And then you start, if white folks could win in black communities, why couldn't black folks win in white communities? Mm-hmm. I mean, you take a woman like Andrea Stewart Cousins from Westchester. Mm-hmm. She was a county legislator, the most expensive county in the United States of America. I'm sure all of her voters were not all black. And she ran against a rather powerful sitting Republican incumbent, a man by the name of Nick Spano, who was the county leader at that point in Westchester. So, and I look at a guy like Antonio Delgado now, who won in a district for Congress that was a 98% white district. We're talking about up in Kingston somewhere. Mm-hmm. So Socrates, I mean, towns you've never even heard of, a lot of people anyway, but you know, so I think that kind of grew organically. And said, well, if Dave Dinkins can do it, I can do it too. And that's the way it happened, basically. But right. You got to remember, I mean, Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. If you ain't taking care of your local politics, you are not going anywhere.
Let me just pause a moment to say you're listening to Max Politics here on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette. You're listening to my conversation with Keith Wright about black political power in New York. Keith Wright, a former two-decade-long member of the New York State Assembly representing parts of Manhattan, particularly Harlem. He is the current leader of the Manhattan Democratic Party, a position he's held for over a decade. He's a vice chair of the New York State Democratic Party. And since leaving the Assembly at the end of 2016 after an unsuccessful run for Congress to replace outgoing Representative Charlie Rangel, he's been working at the lobbying and law and public relations firm Davidoff, Hutcher and Citron LLP, where he's director of strategic planning in the government relations group. Here's more of my conversation with Keith Wright. And that's key. You have to have, if you're going outside of your home base, you have to have your base unified, and then you have to build coalitions as you're getting that, right? And so, you know, we saw that obviously with, as you say, David Dinkins's win. Then we see a different version of a coalition in Eric Adams's win. We obviously saw in Bill de Blasio's win a coalition somewhat similar to the Dinkins coalition, right? In the 2013 mayoral race. Say a little bit about what's happening in Harlem politics today. Obviously, Harlem and how that relates to changes in Harlem, period. This is obviously an area of the city. There's been a lot of attention on changes in Harlem, demographic changes, gentrification, loss of black population in Harlem and other parts of the city. Give a little assessment of what's happening in Harlem broadly and how it's impacting Harlem politics and what you're trying to do there to continue to make sure that Harlem has the representation that it needs in government, and you know how you're organizing in Harlem and in Manhattan.
Well, I mean, certainly it all starts in the city level, and I think we kind of we're in somewhat of a hiccup mode right now with the current city council person, who I never had a conversation with, who, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't really represent a lot of the folks that she's serving. I can guarantee you that most folks in Harlem at this moment don't really know her name. And so now we're going through a city council race right now, because she's obviously sparked a lot of attention from folks that don't want her to be city council person. So we're going through a race right now, and you have Assemblyman Al Taylor, who's running for that position. You have Assemblywoman Inez Dickens running for that position. But you also have a gentleman who I think is creating a lot of excitement right now for that race, a gentleman by the name of Yousef Salam. Mm-hmm. And Yousef Salam certainly is getting a lot of publicity because of his run, because he's formerly one of the Central Park Five, yes, now known as the Exonerated Five, and they were wrongly convicted of the brutal rape of a woman in Central Park in 1989. And who can ever forget that Donald Trump took out a full page ad calling for the death penalty. And I'll tell you, Yousef's mother was an absolute hero. Because she just knew that her son was not guilty of this crime. And she, a lot of times, she was like the lone person out there, you know, talking about that he was innocent, that he was innocent, and he was innocent. And he served, I think, well over 7 years in jail, that starting at the age of 15.
Yeah.
Starting at the age of 15. And I'm very happy that he's decided to throw his hat into the ring and come back and try and make his community a better one.
So is he, it sounds a little bit like he's your candidate in the race, but
I like him. Yes. I mean, I have not endorsed in the race as of yet, but he's,
now that's a tricky race. You have a council member elected in 2021, Kristen Richardson Jordan, in a very crowded race. Now it did have ranked choice voting. So she still had to have, you know, enough second and third and fourth place support, but it was a very, very crowded race. I moderated a debate in that race.
It was like nine people.
It was one of the hardest jobs I've ever had moderating.
How many people was it, Ben? Like,
yeah, it was, I think I had 9 or 10 in the debate, and there might have been a couple others on the ballot. So that was, quite a race.
But now with ranked choice voting, you just don't know. I don't even know how to calculate anything with that. You know, I'm still stuck in a time warp to a certain extent, because I still haven't really figured out ranked choice.
Yeah, well, it gets a little tricky when you have to think about, you know, the second and third and fourth place votes. Usually it results in the idea behind it, right, is that you have a winner that is more of a consensus pick in a crowded field. Now,
that didn't happen in this case.
There's a lot of ways to perhaps look back at
that
this.
That did
race,
not happen, you know, in this case.
So you have this really, there's going to be a lot of focus on the city council primary, which is coming up in June, by the way, for folks listening who haven't tuned into this yet. So you just named three prominent challengers to the sitting council member. Sounds like you have a favorite in the race. So that gets at the root of two things. One, how important is it? And it sounds like this won't be an issue in this election, but how important is it as you look forward? Because we just went through this redistricting process. And one of the things that happened in redistricting was there was a lot of consternation. I don't know how much it got talked about publicly, a little bit, I think, but there was a lot of question about this is the potentially the last redistricting of Harlem in the city council that will ensure there is a black plurality or majority voting population in that district, that if current trends continue, that might not be the case. How important is it as you look to the future, probably beyond this race, as we just talked about, all the candidates mentioned are black, but how important is it for Harlem to be represented by black leaders and to continue to hold on to that identity, that history, amid demographic changes?
Oh, I think it's very important. Listen, as I told you, I live in the same Harlem apartment that I grew up in. And I know what Harlem was. I know what it has been. And I know I have a vision of what I think it could be. Now, of course, there are no more homogeneous neighborhoods anymore. Not that I can name, not in the city of New York. We all live all over the place, except maybe for Park Avenue. But I mean, I just can't really think of any, you know, homogeneous neighborhoods anymore, even out there in Crown Heights and such, because we're all forced to live together. Because if we don't, there's going to be a problem. But I think, you know, Harlem has always been the cultural mecca of the black community. And I think it's important that we keep hold of our cultural values. White folks ain't coming up to Harlem to move up to Harlem because they like black folks so much. They're coming up to Harlem because, you know, it's cheaper and they want to stay in Manhattan. These are some of the white folks that are getting priced out of the market in Gramercy Park, whether it's in Soho, or the Upper West Side or Upper East Side, and you can still continue to live in Manhattan, and that's fine as long as you're good to the neighborhood. You know, good for the neighborhood. It's fine because we all have to live together, as far as I'm concerned. But I think it's important that that the neighborhood certainly keep its cultural values as much as we're able. Now, that being said, you look at certain neighborhoods. I remember, I guess, back in the 50s or the 60s, you know, when black folks were in Brooklyn or in Queens or in Manhattan, if you will, they wanted to buy their first home. They went out to East Elmhurst, Queens, where Malcolm X lived, Louis Armstrong lived, James Brown, I think, had a house out there. And so now East Elmhurst has lost a lot of its black population, and to a certain extent, it's a lot of immigrants. So neighborhoods go through evolutions. East Harlem, I remember when East Harlem, which is the cultural mecca of the Puerto Rican community, East Harlem was Italian. I will never forget that. That's why you have that restaurant Rayo's that's still over there,
right,
in East Harlem. So every neighborhood goes through an evolution, if you will. I mean, it's very cyclical. And I mean, it's just a matter. I mean, I remember when Washington Heights used to be all Irish. And now it's mainly a Dominican neighborhood. So, you know, each neighborhood goes through its evolution. For the most part, it's organic.
Whether it's for Harlem or elsewhere in the city, I went through this roster and it wasn't even a complete one, but I mentioned so many of these prominent black elected officials now. What do they need to do to make sure they're delivering for black voters and black New Yorkers? Are there things they need to focus on more, less, differently, to make sure that, you know, because I don't know that I named a single official who didn't get elected with a base of black voters, a very strong base of black voters. And listen, that's true, you know, obviously in Democratic primaries for so many of these officials, because that was the key race for them to win. But then also in general elections, Governor Hochul, her election was really saved seemingly by black voters in New York City, especially. That gets into general elections a bit more. But in terms of elected officials in the city, from Mayor Eric Adams to public advocate Jumaane Williams and the borough presidents I mentioned and others, are there things you think they need to focus on more, less, differently, to make sure that they're delivering on the things you mentioned earlier in the conversation, those things about just doing the service and making sure that people are being helped when they need help, they're being lifted up when they need to be lifted up, et cetera? Are there things that need to be refocused on or focused on differently in your mind?
Well, what affects black New Yorkers probably affects mostly all New Yorkers. Mm-hmm. I mean, we want our kids to be educated correctly. We want equal access to health care. We want to make sure that our kids and grandkids can get a good job. We want them to be able to find someplace affordable to live. Quite frankly, I don't know how some of these kids are going to be able to do it when they get out of college and stuff. But if they're suffering with student loan debt and trying to find an apartment. I mean, I remember I was basically on my own when I was 17 years old. And I got my own apartment at age, I don't know, 23. So black New Yorkers, what black New Yorkers want and need is not mutually exclusive from what all New Yorkers need. Now, I will say this, there's certain issues that do come up that probably affect black New Yorkers and brown New Yorkers more than white New Yorkers. The situation concerning bail reform. Mm-hmm. It's very important. I remember my father was talking about bail reform back in the 1970s, and he practiced it. That's a situation that criminal justice is something that I think that all black elected officials need to look at and need to focus on and pay some real attention to. Mm-hmm.
And then as you listed off some of those other issues, I mean, immediately some of the current debates that pop to mind relate to the growth of charter schools, questions around housing development. Obviously, that's going to be a major issue in the city council race we were talking about the approach to development and careful development, but the importance of new development and making sure there are housing opportunities for people so that, as you say, when white people are moving into Harlem, they're not just outbidding and displacing black people looking for places.
I'll never forget when I ran for Congress and I lost it by one percentage point. And
2016. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, who's counting anyway?
Sorry, not to bring it up. Yeah. You brought it up.
I sure did. Yeah. Well, I'm a politician in recovery at the moment. So, but I'll never forget the main issue that I was trying to spread far and wide. One of the main issues I was running on is that the way, I guess, the calculation, the how affordable housing is calculated, and it's a federal calculation. And I wanted to change that calculation. When you have the basis of what's affordable goes to something called the area median income and how that's calculated. So they calculate the area median income of all the five boroughs. Right? All the five boroughs.
And I think some surrounding counties.
Well, I'm going to get to that. Right.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I'm going to get to that. So all the five boroughs, and then they bring in to the equation the county of Rockland County and Westchester County, two of the richest counties in the United States of America. So that brings up what is, I guess, deemed affordable when really it isn't affordable. So I wanted to change that dynamic because clearly our folks are having a problem, you know, finding a place to live. Finding a place to live, which is paramount in New York City, to try and make sure that this this city of ours can stay affordable.
Speaking of your 2016 race, and I know we only have a few more minutes together here, I'm speaking with Keith Wright, former assembly member, leader of the Manhattan Democratic Party, among many other titles. That race was a crowded field. There was no ranked choice voting in that race, of course, for Congress, Democratic primary. You narrowly lost to now Congressman Adriano Espaillat in the race to succeed Charlie Rangel. And of course, Espaillat had run against Rangel prior. Were there lessons from that race about trying to ensure more unity among Black political candidates and Black political clubs in the area? Was there anything you took away from that said we can't let this type of thing happen again? Because seemingly, if you had been the only Black candidate in the race, you would have won.
More than likely, yes. And I tried. And we did have unity in the neighborhood behind my candidacy.
Oh, sure. You were far away.
We won Manhattan. We won Manhattan, mm-hmm. The Upper West Side, East Harlem, Central Harlem. And we won the votes in Manhattan. I got my butt kicked in the Bronx.
Section of the district. Yeah.
But that's okay. But what I'm saying, but the lesson that was learned, but the only problem we had two Black people in the race who had no business being in the race. You had a woman named Susan Johnson Cook, who I think was clearly paid off to be in the race. And number two, you had a guy named Clyde Williams, who just because he, you know, worked down in Washington, felt that he was, I guess, qualified to run for Congress. Neither one had really done any sort of public service beforehand. And quite frankly, no one has ever seen either one of them since.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's candidates like that sometimes that are obviously pretty difficult to get out of a race, right?
Yeah. So they had no allegiance to anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, this woman, Susan Johnson Cook, she took an apartment across the street from where I live, and she used that apartment as her residence because she had never lived in Harlem before. She had never lived here before. And then after the race is over, she moved out to Sag Harbor. So you have to have, each community has to have some degree of political discipline, if you will.
Yeah. Let me ask you two more quick questions before I let you go. One, there's a lot of, discussion about the direction of the state Democratic Party here in New York coming out of the 2022 elections, where several House seats were lost, state Senate seats in certain places, Assembly seats in certain places. The governor's fairly narrow margin, closest, gubernatorial race in a couple decades. What do you think has to happen for the state party? What are the couple of biggest keys to, sort of improving how the state party is run in New York? Do you think it's time for new leadership? Should Jay Jacobs step aside? Where do you think the New York State Party needs to go next?
Well, I think Jay Jacobs has done a wonderful job. He's the right person at the right time. I've known Jay Jacobs for decades. And he's a real committed person to the state party process. He's accessible. I know that since we lost a couple of these races, they want to, I mean, somebody's, people are trying to put the blame on Jay Jacobs. And it's misdirected, if you will. You got to remember, in all those congressional races, most of those races are run by the DCCC.
Yeah.
And who is that controlled by Sean Patrick Maloney, who's in the middle of his own race as well. Mm-hmm. So I think to blame Jay Jacobs is misdirected, if you will.
But there are people from Southern Brooklyn who say the state party is just not there for us. You know, this is not just a Long Island congressional race thing. I mean, if it's not on Jay Jacobs, as you say, what does Jay Jacobs need to do in the next phase of leading the party? And obviously you're part of that too.
Yeah, no, that's a fair question. And every organization can always strive to be better. We in the city probably would like to hear from the state party a little more, probably, because I know that the folks in the suburbs and the and when I was state party chair, I did a lot of work upstate and in the suburbs as well. So we have county parties that are very, very good. You name some of those county leaders. Rodney Spachat. I mean, I don't know. I'll just say she's like the James Brown of county leaders. She's the hardest working woman in politics in so many ways. Gregory Meeks. I mean, who's better than him? And Jamal Bailey, who works so hard. So I guess we've never really had a reason to interact or rely on state parties, we in the city. I think they become more, your suburban and your upstate counties tend to try to access state party more. But I think that will change. Mm-hmm. I think that will change. You have 62 counties in the state of New York.
And my last question relates to that, and I know I need to let you go, which is there a way that your Manhattan party that you lead can go into a new phase itself, take a new leadership role in terms of saying, you know what, we're not really running competitive general elections here in Manhattan. How can we sort of push the state party, or how can we do more organizing or more fundraising or whatever it is? Is there a way, just to your point there, that the Brooklyn Democratic Party, that the Manhattan Democratic Party and so forth should be rethinking how you do business related to the state party?
Well, you got to remember, we in Manhattan, we have the luxury of, I don't think we have one Republican here in office, to be honest with you. I can't think of one.
I don't think so. No.
Yeah, right. So we're good. You know what I mean? Let me put it that way. We're good. And so what we do, we have some great activists in Manhattan. I mean, especially from that Upper West Side. And whenever they see a race in upstate New York or even in other states, they take buses and they go out to these other races and they start working along.
Knocking doors.
Yeah, no, they knock on doors. These are some folks that... And sometimes they can be young, but sometimes they can be old. They're walking around with walkers and canes and such, but they're still doing the work. So, I mean, could we work more hand in hand with the state party? Possibly.
And we have to leave it there on a somewhat provocative note from Keith Wright, who's been discussing Black political power in New York and his career in politics with me here on WBAI Radio 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette here on Max Politics. A lot of interesting thoughts from Keith Wright, blending his own experience experiences and assessments of Black political power in New York and politics more generally. A lot of interesting thoughts from Keith Wright there. If you missed any or all of the conversation, there are a couple more minutes left. You can find it all at Max Politics, wherever you get podcasts, or the Gotham Gazette website. Certainly an interesting city council race shaping up in Keith Wright's backyard in Harlem there in this year's elections, with the primary coming up in June. A lot more to look at there in the future. But thank you to Keith Wright for joining me for this conversation. Thank you for listening here on WBAI Radio. Keep on listening this evening and into the weekend. Next week, I'll be joined by Bronx Borough President Vanessa Gibson just after she delivers her State of the Borough address next week. So we'll have a lot to talk about the Bronx, following up on conversations I've had in recent months with the borough presidents of Queens, Manhattan, and Brooklyn. And we're working on the Staten Island Borough President to round out our series, hopefully sometime soon. But Bronx Borough President Vanessa Gibson next week here on Max Politics. Thanks very much for listening. Talk with you soon.